Okay, so I'll step out of the way of the projector. So some powerful stuff there. Hoping to unpack some of that and to contextualise the work of Cine Mujer and these films in particular a little more, we invite Dr. Juana Suarez to talk to us. Juana is a great friend of Birkbeck Institute for the Moving Image, so we were really delighted to have another excuse to invite her over from her post as Associate Arts Professor and Director of the Moving Image Archiving and Preservation Program at NYU Tisch. She is the author of Sitios de Contienda, Producción Cultural y el Discurso de la Violencia, and Sin embargo, Colombia, Ensayos Críticos sobre Cine y Cultura Colombiana, and co-editor of Humor in Latin American Cinema. So she's really the preeminent scholar in the world on Colombian cinema. She's currently working on a research project entitled Audiovisual Archives, Cultural History and the Digital Turn in Latin America, as well as another project entitled Memoria Nacional, Movilidad Transnacional, La Experiencia Fílmica Colombiana en el Extranjero en Años Recientes, which is about Colombian filmmaking outside of Colombia, in particular exilic filmmaking. And that work addresses the work of filmmakers Laura Huertas Millán, Camilo Restrepo, Juan Soto, who we're also very thrilled to have with us again today, Gonzalo Escobar, Felipe Guerrero, and Nicolás Rincón Quille. She has coordinated the collectible set of the restored films of Carlos Mayolo and worked on the preservation of Yurupari, a TV series of ethnographic documentaries about Afro-descendant and indigenous heritage and culture. So we welcome you, Juana.
Thank you so much. Thanks, everybody. Thank you, Janet and Catherine, for the invitation. And Lorena, congratulations for the work you're doing. And thank you for being here this morning. So can everybody hear me? I am going to be talking about an archive that I would say it does not really exist, or it exists in a very precarious state, and to an extent, we work a lot as archivists with orphan films. In a way, I can also say that it's an orphan archive, because it has multiple owners and it lacks a structure. So I have tentatively entitled this talk, The Collective Archive, How to Reconstruct the Memory of Cine Mujer. And I do apologize that some of my images are not very good, but I have a research assistant, and this is mostly what she could draw in many places with her cell phone and with very low light and a lot of lack of direction, because this is something that is not organized. So I want to spend my time doing the following things. I want to talk a little bit about the historical context vis-a-vis Colombian cinema in which Cine Mujer emerges, because I think it's important, the non-existent archive of Cine Mujer. I would like to do a proposal on how I envision that these archives can be reconstructed. Mm-hmm. And I would like to talk a little bit about if there is any legacy of Cine Mujer in contemporary Colombian cinema, or something that I would perceive as the legacy of this group. So let's start by this. Yes, this name has been mentioned today here. Marta Rodriguez, who was born in 1936, is probably the most important Colombian filmmaker. I do consider Marta a treasure of Latin American cinema, and no doubt an iconic woman of world feminist cinema, even though she doesn't acknowledge herself or she doesn't identify herself like that. Marta has been doing film since 1958. She started working with Jan Rusch. She actually, she's an emigre to Spain because she was very unhappy with the possibilities that women had in the 50s in Colombia. And then she migrated to Spain only to run into Franco's Spain. So she went to France, and she's been making films since 1958. But I would say that Marta, along with Gabriela Samper, are the two pioneer women of Colombian cinema. Gabriela Samper was born in 1918, and she died in 1974. I'm not going to devote time about these two women, but it's very important to know what was before Cine Mujer and in what context they appear. So Gabriela Samper was, as many of these women, a woman of social pedigree, a very bourgeois woman who opted to have a very independent life as an art critic, as a filmmaker. And I think that this is also very important, because it has to do part of what we have to do with Sene Mujer, what we do when we do archival work and when we do archival work with minorities, with underrepresented groups. It also demands a lot of reparation and a lot of verification of data and a lot of correction. So Gabriela Samper is an example that I am going to come back later. Gabriela Samper was politically persecuted, and she spent a couple of years in prison in Colombia, allegedly because she supported the Maoist group ELN, Ejército de Liberación Nacional, the National Liberation Army. She then went in exile, and I think that she was protected by Cornell University. I have not been able to locate the records that she actually studied at Cornell and Columbia University, but this is the version that her daughter shares when she is interviewed. And upon leaving jail by 1974, she died extremely young. She got cancer and a lot of depression. But I also think it's important, Gabriela is here with Jorge Silva, Marta Rodriguez's husband. And I think it's very important also to look at these colectivos, like Cine Mujer, and all these work group in the 60s and the 70s as a result of the euphoria of the Cuban Revolution. The fact that the Cuban Revolution, one of the first institutions that is created in Cuba after the revolution, is the ICAIC, no, the Instituto Cubano de Arte e Industria Cinematográfico. And I think it's very important because this idea of working together was pretty much embedded at the time. And it's something that Cine Mujer is really going to pick up, but to say how we as women can do this. So there is that, and I think that the fact, the social status is also absolutely important. There should be, this is Marta, very recently you have in the background a still from Nuestra Voz de Memoria Tierra y Futuro, who has been recently restored by Arsenal, and this is very important to think how these films can travel through time and the importance of film preservation. Marta has gotten very good deals for her work to survive because she really has the most important archive on violence in Colombia. And number two, because she has been obsessive about the care of the photography of her husband. Jorge was a very famous photographer. And because she has done very good deals with the companies that distributed films in Europe. She was very important in the 70s, 80s. And so those companies are telling her, we will pay for the restoration of the film, which is really expensive, whether it is U-matic or 16 millimeter or 35 millimeters, and we can talk a little bit about that because I think that's one of the obstacles for the survival of the work of Cine Mujer, the cost of curating this archive. And so they have kept the rights to distribute in Europe, but they have liberated for her to be able to have some independence in the States and Latin America, and both Chircales and Nuestra Voz de Tierra, Memoria y Futuro, who are emblematic films of this woman filmmaker, have been very well restored. So there is another woman that I am not mentioning here, but that is also very important, and she belongs more to the history of television in Colombia. This is the decade of the 60s, 70s, in the 80s, and it's very similar, and I think it will be wonderful to have this archive to compare the work. Gloria Triana, Catherine mentioned that I have been working in the restoration of Yurupari. Yurupari was a very important ethnographical series in Colombia in the 80s. Those were 64 documentaries, half an hour each, made between 1982 and 1986. And it's really a mapping of the indigenous and Afro-descent cultures in Colombia. And the dates are very important because in 1990, and this is also why this the very first work of Cine Mujer is also very important, because in 1990, Colombia revised the constitution. And many of these groups of campesinos, gypsies, African descent communities, and indigenous communities were only recognized by the constitution in 1990. And when you see this kind of interview, I can see all the similarities, the Yuruparis. If you simply Google Yurupari, which is Y-U-R-U-P-A-R-I, we had been uploading into Señal Memoria, the public television archive, everything that we have restored. But the procedure is very much the same. It's approaching people that are like Carmen Carrascal, but the big difference for me is the point of view, because here we're listening to Carmen Carrascal. In Yurupari, Gloria is always using voice over, so she's always speaking for the other. However, it's been very important material to keep because it's the only audiovisual inventory that we have of Colombia before 1990, and then after 1990, we had like the highest peak of drug-related violence, no? The two cartels. But also, it's very important because the Yuruparis, most of them were made in 16 millimeters for... It was called Cine para Televisión, Cinema for Television. So they were 16 millimeters, but they had to be transferred to magnetic support so that they could be broadcasted on television. And that was also paid by Focine. I didn't worry. excuse me. And sorry that I have a little cold. That was also paid by Focine, and the fact that Proimágenes Colombia, which is the most important mixed fund, the only one that we have in Colombia for filmmaking, has been careful about its archive, has allowed us to start the restoration of those documentaries by doing a lot of international fundraising. I think I can lobby for the ones that belong to Focine, the ones that were made with sobreprecio, with the surcharge law. Actually, it was never a law. It was just a decree. It was never really a law that Lorena mentioned. So if I were going to start a procedure, an archival procedure on Cine Mujer, the first thing that we always look at in archives is copyright, because copyright these days is everything. And as you were showing, Y tu mamá qué hace, I was thinking this short film will be very problematized these days because obviously there is music appropriation. I think it's Chocolate Armenteros, the one that is playing Cocinando. And nowadays when you restore one of these films, everybody jumps saying, you used my music 20 years ago, you used my music 30 years ago, you didn't pay any rights at the moment, and I want my money. And that, for example, is a musician that is extremely expensive. But I think this is a very important document. This is a letter from November 17, 1999, and it's a letter that Patricia Alvear, who was working at the moment as advisor, as consultant for Cine Mujer, wrote to donate Cine Mujer Archive to the Colombian Film Heritage Foundation, Fundación Patrimonio Filmico Colombiano. So what they do is that they explain here that after 20 years, they really feel that they don't have the economic means anymore to keep the project going on, and that they would like for the films to be given to the National Film Archive so that they can be used for educational purposes, and that they also feel that they are giving it to friendly hands, and that they expect that by giving the films to the National Archive, their legacy will keep alive. Also, I think that this in archives, of course, this figure that you are donating something. No, because we always talk about the state of the archive, who has the state of the filmmaker, and what is it that you're doing with it. So I think that that's one of the ways to advocate. This was a donation. This was a gift from Cine Mujer. Hence, it should be taken care of, and it should be made public for people to be able to access that. So I think that this is a very important document, no? Because also, if they are signing a Cine Mujer and the logo is there, none of the filmmakers, I think that they have a very healthy relationship after the years, but none of the filmmakers will be able to come and claim individual rights of a piece of work. Now, so in a way, this could be considered public dominion if it were going to be restored. So this piece of information is also very important because there are only five films that were made in 35 millimeters. I imagine that they were made in 16 millimeters and they were blown out to 35 millimeters. And all the other work is mastered in 3/4. No, and so there's also, of course, all this work that you have to do purging an archive, because you really need to check when you're working with magnetic media if whatever is labeled as master is indeed the master, and if the master is in good condition as to do a restoration, or if you prefer to take another surrogate that might be in better condition. But it's the part of the archive that fits into what we call collection assessment, no? Which is really something that has to be done with this archive. someone has to do the collection assessment of the films. I know that they are in patrimonio, they are safe, but patrimonio does lose things once in a while. Luis Ospina and I desperately look for a film he had made in UCLA, and after really fighting a lot at the archive, they were able to find it. It was misplaced. It was the same thing with the first film by Victor Gaviria. So they do misplace things. But then there's also in the when I look at this letter in the there's this was the letterhead from the Cine Mujer, and on the bottom of the page they had that little picture that says there with the address. Which is very ironic that it was around my house in Colombia, my last house in Colombia. And Patricia Restrepo used to show me all the time when we walk around my house, this is where Cine Mujer was. But they have a little motto, which I read as a mission statement. And I think it's very important to recover that. Because it used to say, asesoría, producción, préstamo de material audiovisual sobre mujer, género, participación y desarrollo. So it really translates... Mm-hmm. Consulting, production, lending audiovisual materials on women and gender participation and development. And I think that mission statement, in a way, needs to be recovered now, which is what we have here. Both things, when you work in an archive, are absolutely important. The copyright status of materials and what is the mission statement of the institution. What were you planning to do? What is your institution about? Who is the population that you serve? Where is your fund? Where does your funding come from, etc.? And I think that this can be like founding stones to be able to erect this archive again. This is just a mental reminder, because this is a rack of Cine Mujer. When you go to the Colombia Film Heritage neighbors the National University, which is kind of ironic. And the National University has the School of Gender, School of Women and Gender Studies, and they got part of the Cine Mujer archive. My speculation is that the materials are divided. There had to be surrogates of the UMATIC films at the Escuela de Género, at the gender school, but they are in very bad shape now. And they have a lot of books. They have like this rack that they say that is really about Cine Mujer. It's not all these books are about Cine Mujer. These books might have two or three pages about Cine Mujer. So what would be important would be to really extract the material from here, digitize it, create very good PDFs, create very good bibliographical reference, and put them in a place where people can really consult them. Now, this is mostly literature in Spanish, but Cine Mujer is mentioned in very scattered ways by very important Latin American film scholars such as Julian Burton in The Social Documentary in Latin America, John Keane in Magical Reels, in a lot of literature from the 80s and the 90s, there are scattered mentions to Cine Mujer. The lack of availability of the materials is, of course, an obstacle for people to be able to do research on these films. Also, Cine Mujer lasted over 20 years, but this is like the founding group: Patricia Restrepo, Lalia Carrizosa, Clara Riasco, Sara Bright, Rita Escobar, Dora Cecilia Ramirez, and Fanny Tubón came like 4 or 5 years later, but was a very important figure to help organize the group. But this is not the group that end Cine Mujer, because as Lorena mentioned, they moved to television, and many of them survived by working for Sempro and for Audiovisuales Colombia, which are two companies that are disappeared, but they were really television companies. But this is not the fate only of women in the 80s. Most men that were working in Colombian cinema also ended up working on television. I think the only two people that had really resisted, or perhaps the three people that had resisted to work on television, had been Marta Rodriguez, Victor Gaviria, and Luis Ospina. Although Luis Ospina did a lot of films for Telepacifico, the Southwest Regional Television Company. But this is because Focine, which I also think is very important to underline, and I don't know to what extent, Lorena, you have worked on your research on this. Focine, yes, in Latin America, when people say that it's a state-funded cinema, like Incine, Inca, Embrafilme, Focine, in Colombia, sounds a little bit like Arcadia, no, like, of the state sponsored cinema in these countries. It's always a mess. It's always a mess, no? And I think it's more interesting the dirty story of those state-sponsored companies than the official stories that they have written. Focine lasted from 1978 to 1993. That's 15 years. Now, they had 8 managers during the 15 years. Now, and they have, in one single year, they had 5 managers. Now, Focine was also dismantled because of scandals of corruption that are very evident and very clear, and because I handle the archive of Proimágenes, I have seen really dirty documents, no? That you are like, oh my God, it would be so good to be able to pull these documents out, that I most of the time had to write that I am just looking for whatever I'm commissioned and not looking at anything else, but there were really a lot of financial scandals. When Focine closed in 1993, Colombian cinema, which was never really a great cinematography, so when people are so generous as to say that I wrote the book on Colombian cinema, it's really a book about disaster. No. But from 1993 to 2003, which is the creation of the law of cinema under which Colombian cinema is operating right now, that was revised in 2013, and that is successful because Colombian cinema has more visibility across the globe, is going, if it is measured because it's present in festivals, then it's successful cinema. No, but not everybody is happy. It's a very transparent model, very far away from the corruption that characterized Focine. Proimágenes is a very transparent mixed fund. But the politics of Colombian cinema need to be scrutinized. That's another discussion. So, but that Focine period is important because from 1993 to 2003, we only made some 5 or 6 films. And of course everybody decided to go to television because that's where the jobs were. There are multiple interviews and they are not always, this is an interview to Patricia Restrepo in Kinestocopio, which used to be a leading journal on cinema in Medellin. But the interviews are never, in the case of Patricia Restrepo, is very important because the interviews are never really about Cine Mujer. Cine Mujer appears always sandwiched among the questions as a time of your life in which you work with these other women. In the case of Patricia and Lorena starts, you start your, the film that you show us today with Patricia presiding. It's very interesting because Patricia, yes, was part of the Caliwood, of the Grupo de Cine de Cali, but she has been very ostracized. I think that she is the real survivor of Cine Mujer. Patricia is a script doctor. She is a professor of script writing at Universidad Nacional. Her daughter is a filmmaker, graduated from NYU, and she's always surrounded by people of cinema. But for her, it has been a real battle for people to move her, which is the story of a lot of women and artist filmmakers, to read her work alone, not next to Luis Ospina, Carlos Mayolo, and Andrés Caicedo, particularly because she was involved sentimentally both with Andrés Caicedo and with Carlos Mayolo, and also because the circumstances of the suicide of Andrés Caicedo were very, very extenuating, and there had been people that had really profited from that story against her will. So it's been a real battle for her to tell people, I am a filmmaker, or I wanted to be a filmmaker. Now that I interviewed her for this, she told me, when we were closing the interview, she said, well, she's a very lovely person, calm, as you see her in the film. And she told me, well, so many memories, tantos recuerdos. And then she said, in my next life, perhaps, no, en mi próxima vida. So she always feels like a non-accomplished filmmaker. And you can see the works. The works are there. The archive is there. There are multiple attempts. This is a DVD collection called Cine Mujer. Couldn't find the date. There have been multiple attempts to publish the work of Cine Mujer. And what happened is that there were telecines in the 90s. There were telecines made and then transferred to DVD. But we all know that optical media is obsolete by now. Computers no longer have the toaster for optical media. So they keep making these DVD collections, but I mean, for a lot of millennials, for example, the DVDs are like, what do I do with this? No. So there have been multiple attempts to organize this. And then they put them, the films, this is the Fondo de Documentación Mujer y Género, this is from the school, it is named after a woman, Ofelia Uribe da Costa. Then the films sometimes come in collections like Women and Politics, but there has never really been a collection of Cine Mujer films, which I don't think is that difficult to do. There are also multiple catalogs. This is a catalog that is the catalog of the Women and Gender Studies Center of the Universidad Nacional, of the National University. I do think that this is very important because when you are working with archives and you don't have much money, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You have to take advantage of whatever exists. What is very good about this catalog is that it has good technical information, information that you usually see in catalogs, no? Kind of film, if it is documentary or fiction, who is the director, running time, Cine Mujer is the producer, Colombia, then the descriptions tend to be very good. And it has something that I think is very important, that this is already doing keywords that in contemporary catalogs become tagging, because the future of the archive is being open on the websites, on the internet. You don't want to have to sign into a university library to be able to access their holdings. You want to know what they have. And they have things like daily life, sexual roles, children, family, women discrimination, socialization. So I think that all this information can be reused into creating a real catalog. Also, this catalog, of course, I put this page because you have something by Grupo Chasqui, which was a collective from Peru. And you have this. So this is not a catalog only on Cine Mujer. It's a catalog on work by women and on women. But I think that this can be, this is if you need to catalog the work, there is already like a good foundational stone. And it has many of the works of Sarah Bright, Eulalia Carrizosa, but you were mentioning that you're working with Lourdes Portillo, so it's a very combined catalog, but you can still rescue a lot of material. Very important for what Cine Nova is doing, the Achilles heel of Colombian cinema up to this day keeps being distribution. In Colombia, we have been unable to figure out how to distribute our cinema. Not only the films made by Cine Mujer, even the most important filmmakers that probably you hear mentioned in these days, Ciro Guerra, Cristina Gallego, Ruben Mendoza, Luis Ospina, we have an issue with distribution. We have not found a good model. I am very impressed that Cine Mujer did think very early about distribution. It was not successful, but there was that impetus, which is very important. I think the footnote is interesting because it says all the titles, todos los títulos están disponibles en Betamax. All the titles are available in Betamax. No. So this is also a problem because an archive is about upgrading the format, and that's the most expensive part, mainly because we are trapped in a very technological war right now. That and filmmakers sometimes lack a lot of education about the archive, so they don't know if they should be making DCPs, if they should be having digital copies. Sometimes they don't understand that a digital transfer is not a restoration per se. A restoration for the Yurupari's, our average of expense for every Yurupari, 25 minutes, which is very similar to the work of Cine Mujer. Our average cost is $15,000 per each, very basic restoration, I think it's a little bit more. I get to get free scannings because I ask everybody, can you scan this for me? She started doing it with Cine Mujer. So that was a distribution attempt. This is a very poor catalog, which is not very telling, but it's important because they tried to create categories at the time that they did the films, and I think it's the most complete inventory of all the films. So these documents are not centralized. These documents are scattered in the houses of the filmmakers, at the Universidad Nacional, at the Luis Ángel Arango, which is the most important public library in Colombia, at Patrimonio Filmico, so they totally lack of centralization. My research assistant in Colombia had to go with the cell, and she kept sending me WhatsApp messages. Do I make copies of this? Do you want this? Do you see any use on this? So also because it's the kind of research that you either pay a person in Colombia or you have to do in situ, and it can be very expensive. So I do think it's important. For me, the concept of activism in the archives is very important. You do these lectures, and so what? No. You explain the problem, and so what? So I think that having a proposal on how to reconstruct the memorias in a mujer is important. This is something that I will propose. This is, on the right, you have a copy of Patricia Restrepo's script, Ahora Vengo Yo. She never made this film, but she has to use a pseudonym for contest, and she chose Alfredo Garcia. No. She had to sign like a man. But I think it's very important to recover these documents, and these documents are like written in Word 1997, so they are fading out. It's very important to recover this material. But I do think it's very important to centralize the materials from Patrimonio, from the Luis Ángel Arango Library, from the Gender Studies, add materials from filmmakers' personal collections. I don't know what was your experience. We can talk about that in the next section. But some of them don't want to be interviewed. They don't want to talk about Cine Mujer. It's like they move forward. They left that behind. No need to go back to that. Material, gather materials published as well. Julian Burton, John Keane, etc. I think this part, which is what Lorena is doing, is very important. We have to create a memoir of all these filmmakers. Yeah, and it's very important to do films with them. Most of these women are 65, 68, 70 now. We cannot take everything for granted. Age is not really a factor to die these days. But it will be very important to film them and to create podcasts, no? And to make ourselves sure that we're creating a robust digital archive so that the things do not disappear, like what happened to MySpace 2 weeks ago, no? That you have all these digital assets and suddenly they disappear. There's also their need to do an inventory of film negatives, masters, check status of the copies, plan upgrade to new technologies, and I think this is the most important part, because this should really be lobby, that this should be common access, public access, because it was a donation that this group did to National Cinema. There should be a digital repository that has shared governance now, and dispersed locations. I imagine that a repository can be done. The Europaris that we have been restoring are all being uploaded to public television in Colombia, because that was paid with money from Colombian taxes 30 years ago. And that Gloria Triana is the director, but she signed contracts. She doesn't own any kind of loyalty from those, and it's the case with these documentaries. So this is not very difficult to do, because it's really mainly about scanning photographs. It's like gathering the materials. What really works for this, and will be wonderful if in the conference that you're planning to do in Spain, something that is very useful here is the idea of community archiving. If you can bring these women together to a location with their boxes, no, and they help identifying the materials. They sit down with you, go with you through the materials, and they identify. These are the pictures of S film. These pictures belong to this episode. This is the negative of this. It will be wonderful. It's a little bit utopic, because I know one of them lives in Villa de Leyva, Sara is in Andalusia, Patricia is in Colombia. But if you could try to do it, and I don't think it's a model only for Cine Mujer. It's a model for a lot of groups that have archival material. Do a community archiving session in which people come together and identify materials and collaborate. And you sign new documents that they are giving permission to use those materials. Because everything, when you get to the moment to publish a book, whether as an e-book or as a material book, everything will get stuck in copyright. So I think that something that is very important in any project that we do about archives is let's get legal. Because lawyers, Amazon, and everybody wants a bite from us. So it's very important to start the process with the right legal procedure. Why will this be important? Because this will be access. This is access of existing information. This will provide new research. This will provide new insights. Conversation with similar historical moments, permanence. And I think that this is very important, because in every single interview, Sara Bright, who is the person that started Cine Mujer, and we are in London today, Sara was coming back to Colombia from studying film in London. And she always acknowledges influence from second wave feminism. But it will be very important to really talk to them and say, what feminists were you reading? When you acknowledge yourselves as feminists, what kind of feminism were you practicing? When Patricia acknowledges in that documentary that the materials were given to her by Luis Ospina, I think that that's very important, is who was having access to the materials in the 80s and who was being generous enough to share it with other people when it was not of importance to him or to her. But it's always struck me, this idea of that they, two or three of them in interviews say, we belong to the second wave of feminism. Patricia even says, to the second wave of feminism in Colombia. And I keep thinking, what was the first wave of feminism in Colombia? Most friends my age have a hard time to identify themselves as feminists. I am a non-apologetic feminist. Now, I just did a podcast that with Deborah Shaw for a radio station in Colombia, and it's the first thing that I said. We are always, thank you for coming. We're going to try to make this not very feminist so that you're comfortable. No. And I think that this is very important because this will allow us to tell us a very imperfect story. Because these groups have issues. They had technology problems. They had learning problems. Patricia told me that they got money from the Ford Foundation for equipment, but there is no record whatsoever of what money did the Ford Foundation give them. What happened with that equipment? Also, Patricia tells me that in many cases, they try to be very skillful with the camera, and the men that they used to work with sometimes were very sympathetic. Usually they had this, you know, I should be doing camera. It's going to be very difficult for you now. But I think this is the story of women after all. And I think that this is important, and I want to go back to Gabriela Samper, and I want to say this with due respect. Everything that has been written about Gabriela Samper has been told through the lens of her daughter, who is also a filmmaker, not as successful as her mother, and I would say not as talented as her mother. But she has told a version of the films of Gabriela Samper. I did a paper in NYU many years ago about the films of Gabriela Samper because I went to MoMA and I was looking at some other stuff and suddenly her name came on a batch of papers. And then I realized everything that is in my book, in my 2009 version of my book about Gabriela Samper needs to be corrected because I trusted my informant a lot. And then I realized everything here. Cities in Crisis, which is a very important film, it always appears like directed by Ray Whitlin and Gabriela Samper. When I look at the documents, it was only directed by Ray. She was the associate director. Yeah. And then these things, like who paid for this? Universal Education and Visual Arts, because it's a film that has always been sold as experimental, and it's not that educational video cannot be experimental, but it was not born as an experimental film. It was born as a commissioned film by the Universal Education and Visual Arts Unit of Universal Cinema. And then what I notice in all these films is that the name of Gabriela does not really appear as a director. No. It's, for example, Santísimos Hermanos, which is a very important film by Gabriela. Maddie always says it was directed by my mother. And then you go and see the documents and it says directed by Gabriela Samper, Rebecca Puche, and Hernando Sabogal. So we are again on correcting information into history because we cannot tell the story of women from lies and from fictional facts. That's the possibility that we have when we correct an archive, that we have to really say, this is what Cine Mujer did, these are the credits, these are the men that work with them. So now, my last part is wondering if there is a legacy of Cine Mujer. Cine Mujer is not very famous in Colombia. I was very surprised when Catherine and Janet told me that you guys have interest in doing this. Because if you ask most women filmmakers that are between 20 and 30 years in Colombia, they have no idea that Cine Mujer existed. And they had no idea that Cine Mujer existed for 20 years. The fact that we cannot watch the films because the films had not been restored also invisibilizes more their work, yeah, negates their existence. So really, it's a very important task to recover their films. These are three images from an activity that we did in 2016. Patricia worked with me in this activity. It was called Los Lugares de las Mujeres en el Cine Colombiano, The Places of Women in Colombian Cinema. And this was, it was a coincidence. And I know Juan is laughing because Juan is part of this association. But this is 2016. This is not 19th century, or this is not the beginning of cinema. When we created that activity, we said we used this picture that was very published by the Association of Colombian Editors in Filmmaking. Now, and they were very proud, and there are people here that I simply love, like Gustavo Vasco, Etienne Busac, Rodrigo, Felipe Guerrero, Sebastián. They all are my friends, my beer friends, my dancing friends. Juan lives in London, so he's not in the picture, right? Are you part of the association?
I am.
Yes, he's part of the association. And there was one woman. And I was thinking, this is impossible in, it's not true in analog times of the archive. Because the most important negative cutter in Colombia was a woman, Emma Frade. Yeah. Gloria Triana did not know about cinema. She learned how to use a camera so that she can make the Juruparis. Yeah. Marta Rodriguez has always worked with men, but she knows how to use a camera. And she knows how to edit, and she knows how to direct an editing session. So it's this idea of erasing women for technology, which I think cannot happen anymore, and not in the archive. The archive is a place to restore our visibility, because it will tell in how many places and in how many jobs and in how many positions we have worked in cinema. Now, and when I created this activity, I did not want it to perpetuate, which I think is very cliche. I keep seeing encounters and feminist discussions around women called women behind the camera. Mm-hmm. Women behind the camera. And I think that whole idea of women behind the camera has really negated our presence, because we have been in front of the camera, on the side of the camera, under the camera, next to the camera, moving the camera, carrying the camera, loading the camera, no, uploading what is produced by the camera, etc. So it was my idea was like, let's displace the conversation of Colombian cinema from these, the women behind the camera. Because then it will always be Gabriela, Marta, Cine Mujer, and four or five women that are really known in Colombian cinema. So this was a picture that helped us, and this was a part of the promotion that we did. And this was our Facebook page, which is still active. And it says something like, we have been, we are, and we will be many more. Now, and we had Marta, because we really wanted to pay. It was a very open activity. We wanted to acknowledge history, so we had Marta. We had Patricia. We had the high version and the low version. We have Claudia Triana, who is the director of Pro Imágenes, and is the person with the most power in Colombian cinema, because she's the one that handles the mixed fund. But she's also very responsible for a lot of these films to survive, because one very good thing about Claudia, she cares about the archive. She started the Colombian Film Heritage in 1983. And then we also included Diana Bustamante, who is a producer, former director of the Cartagena Film Festival, Mechi Gaviria, who is a sonidist and filmmaker, she's the daughter of Victor Gaviria, Laura Huertas Villan, Pilar Perdomo, she's a filmmaker and video artist, sonidist, Patricia Restrepo, Lydia, who is a director, and a film critic and programmer on the right, Jenny Rodriguez, because it was very important to really move the idea of the collective of women making film to how many places women occupy. So we did social media. We have Camila Lobo Guerrero, who is also an important filmmaker from the 80s. And this is important because between the film, but that was fiction. Camila Lobo Guerrero made her film in 1983, and the second film, fictional film directed by a woman, only happened 25 years later in Colombia. Now, so this is important. Is there a legacy of Cine Mujer? No. There has only been one collective in Colombia, which is called Mujeres Audiovisual. They have a website called Cine en Femenino. I was looking for images for this PowerPoint, and then I realized that they had that tweet since November 2017, and I realized that's the month when Jimena, the director of the collective, had the baby. So we are still stuck in the same problem. Maternity, no, curtails our possibility to work in cinema. And when you talk, for example, to Patricia Restrepo, you probably experiment this. She said, I left Cine Mujer because I wanted to be a mother. And then my task was how to reinvent feminism from my position as a very traditional mother. No, but I think that this is an important discussion. There's another group, I think that this is my last slide, that goes in tandem with what you were saying. Visaje is not a group of, is not a collective of women, but it's a film magazine from the Universidad del Valle run by women. Now, they publish men, they publish gender fluidity, they publish women, but it was an attempt. They just decided that it was not good, that it was not good to work as a collective, because they felt that they were going backwards on the language of the 80s, the 70s, and the 60s, and they wanted to have a more digital presence. So it's a digital magazine. It's also interrupted now because Luisa, what's the last name of Luisa?
Luisa González
is studying in Amsterdam. But I wanted to leave you with this image because
It says, La Mujer en el Grupo de Cali, Entrevista con Cali Lamazone, which is exactly what you were talking about. Women in the Cali group. No, the Grupo Gliso Espina. Yes, films like Todo Comenzó con el Fin are films that totally invisibilize women. No, they talk about the position that women have had in film as muses. And I think it's very telling that in Todo Comenzó por el Fin, and I know that a lot of people are like very fond of Gliso Espina films, but if you pay attention to the film, there's always a frame in which there's a red curtain and the former girlfriends of Gliso Espina come and tell him how much they have loved him and how much they love him. So Karen Lamazona, who was married to him, is one of those. Patricia also has to come and say how much she loves Andres and Carlos. And so it's like a very continuous framing that is all about, I mean, the film proposes that it's all about sex, music, and drugs. I was not very scandalized. I have seen more than that at my short age. But I think the idea of sex there was very much like, we have all these women, no? Although they are talking to makeup artists and they are talking to some other important women. Also, I know that there is a lot of unhappiness on the way that was edited because it really perpetuates the idea that the only position that women like Patricia Restrepo had in cinema is having been the lover of Andrés Caicedo, no? And so this is a woman that is 65 now, but is still struggling to have her name placed in the right line of Colombian history of cinema. No. And I think it's very important to look at the these films. So thank you so much for the invitation, and thanks to Patricia and to Maria Posada. Patricia says that she's very willing to collaborate and to make her second donation. She has some materials. What we have been, and I don't know, Lorena, you had more luck. We had really been unable to locate a lot of photography. No, it's like a collective without static image. That's it. Thank you so much.
Okay, so we've got about half an hour before the lunch break in which we can we can open it up for your questions as well. So
Thank you.
I will have a chair. I will stop being.
Y se supone que sí que fue fundado con dinero público. Lo que pasa
claro,
que había mucha cosa.
Taxes. Sí, fueron 15 años de.
Thank you.
Lo que pasa es que yo trabajo para ProImágenes como consultora de archivo y por eso hice el set de Mayolo. Y ahora hicimos el set de Gaviria. Entonces me toca mirar muchos documentos de la época. No, estamos buscando siempre lo de copyright. Para la película de Víctor Gaviria estábamos mirando a ver si encontrábamos el recibo de Pink Floyd, porque se pagaron $7,000 en su momento por derecho de música.
Okay. So, that was a tour de force by Juana, for which yes. We're eternally grateful. And in particular, she raised lots of the issues we hoped that today would raise about, in a way, making bare the device of distribution and archiving. We talk a lot about laying bare the device in film production. We've seen some of that as well today already. But the collective mechanics of keeping these films and bringing these films and maintaining the memory of these films is worth thinking about in the kinds of practical ways that Juana was just articulating. It's a form of activism. It's activity that is a form of activism, and it's something that all of us, I think, in the room should be thinking about from our own locations. So we're really grateful. But having set all of that up, I kind of wanted to turn back to the texture of the films mm-hmm. that we saw. Because this is the Essay Film Festival, and this is a form that is constantly in question. What is the essay film? And in one respect, the two films that we screened are a kind of classic feminist objects from the 70s and early 80s that we would expect to be in a feminist archive. This is a sort of circular argument. But I am really interested, and we were when we were programming today, in the open texture of those two films. And I think, you know, the use of comedy. We don't see too many funny essay films. So I would argue that that's a funny essay film. But I'm also particularly interested in Carmen Carrascal, not an especially funny film, although there's something there in the tone as well, with the donkey sequence, the mule sequence. I'm really interested in that film, given how people like Patricia and the other members of the collective frame their films as this work towards positive images of women, this important work of positive images of women. Now, it's absolutely the case that both of those films portray, in their way, positive images of women, but Carmen Carrascal also portrays something else. It's not interested in a simplistic rhetoric about positivity, or even a simplistic rhetoric about complexity and roundness. It is a portrait film, so it is one of the kind of accepted genres of the essay film. It does offer great space to the voice of the person figured in the film, Carmen Carrascal. But it also kind of goes on into a phase which, according to Julia Lesage in Julianne Burton's collection, Social Documentary in Latin America, a great chapter in that book, which is actually readable online, so you can easily read this, called Women Make Media, where she looks at the work of Cine Mujer. She says that, in a way, that's where the horizontality of Cine Mujer's collective production process is. If not breaks down, then is challenged, because Carmen Carrascal, it wasn't that she didn't want that bit about her illness to be in the film, but she didn't want the song to be in the film. And she was involved in every other decision about how she portrayed herself in the film, but she wasn't involved in the editing. So I've thrown out a few things there about the form of the film, and I wondered if you wanted to say something. Lorena, do you want to respond in any way?
I didn't talk much about Carmen, about how that happened, how they decided to add the song, even though clearly Carmen Carrascal didn't want to have that insight. But they, during the production, they spent quite a lot of time with her. Eulalia Carrizosa moved to that little town in the north of Colombia to live with Carmen Carrascal for like 3 weeks before the film started, just to discuss with her the topics that they were going to ask her about and how they wanted to make the film. So I guess there were some kind of horizontal elements there in the terms that they were discussing together how the film was going to come together, even though there had been previous discussions with the rest of the members of the collective about how they wanted to make the film. And then everyone else arrived and spent some time filming with Carmen Carrascal. So Eulalia was in charge of this film. She directed it, but she doesn't like to credit herself as a director as well, because she saw it as a collective discussion with members of Colectivo Cine Mujer and then with Carmen Carrascal. Although, she didn't, she wasn't involved in the editing, so she didn't have a final say about what it was part of it. Yeah.
But I think my experience with Yurupari showed me two things. One is that there's a great deal of depth here with Marta Rodriguez, no? Because Marta is the one that really brings that process of ethnographical documentary to Colombia, no? The observant participant, no? And I think that there's a big effort here to let Carmen talk, but you can hear the very subtle voice of her saying, of the interview, and saying, ¿por qué? No, ¿cuándo? Like, trying to drag more information, although he's trying to hide. But for me, working in the restoration of Yurupari, and also because Gloria is still alive, and Gloria has been pushing for her films, has shown me that the real a lack of balance in the way these films were produced and shown is that the communities never saw it. So is we're still stuck in the tradition of people going with the camera and make films about other communities, but never giving them the opportunity to see their films. And of course, they can always talk about horizontality, but I think it's horizontality as members of the collective. I think it's really impossible to say, I am also horizontal with the subject of my documentary. With the Europaris, we have taken back the documentaries to a couple of towns. I mean, this is 30 years after, 30 years after aggravated by violence. And people cry because they see their grandparents. Or women see when they were 14 years old, and now they are 44. And it's pretty much also about officios, about trades, like this kind of trade. But I think that that's the thing, that as a filmmaker, you can tell Carmen, don't worry, the sun is not going to be there. But Carmen is never going to make it to the edition, to the editing room. And it's, I mean, I wonder if she ever saw the finished product.
I think she did. I think they went there. It was difficult to screen it because there wasn't any electricity where Carmen lived. Mm. And they had to. They organized a public screening in a town nearby, and they saw it. And I don't have any knowledge about her, what Carmen Carrascal said about it. But I think she did see it. Yeah.
I wonder if the, because the song, which is probably where she kind of wants to exercise some censorship, not the fact that she was sick probably and having deliriums or something like that, but it's the pun that she makes that when we were single, you used to call me something like Carmen, my love, no? And now you call me an animal, no? Which is, rhymes with her name, Carmen Carrascal, un animal, no? Mm-hmm. She was probably afraid of Umberto.
Yes, you know? I think. and in a way, that's one of the, for me, the open, more essayistic aspects of the documentary, is its lack of interest in him.
Yeah.
You know, he's in the background, and he's referred to almost as this kind of mythical ballad sort of figure, and referred to by Carmen, but he is excluded from the space of the documentary.
Yeah.
And the space of her overflowing speech. I wonder what you thought about that. I don't know if you needed to think about the subtitles, because you can access the film in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
But there is so little of that dialogue that appears in the subtitles.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I don't know why that happened. Mm. Yeah, it's surprising, because then there are lots of interesting bits that are missed that she says, that are not.
Can you think of anything that struck you in particular today?
I need a moment to think. Yeah.
On the subtitles?
Yeah, that there wasn't that she said that wasn't subtitled.
Well, I mean, part of it is just her speech patterns. So she has a very reiterative way of talking. So what you're missing from the subtitles is that her essence as a speaker, her way of talking about her life. I mean, it gives you really the bare minimum. It doesn't miss out any really, really important facts, but it does rather remove the possibility of being able to access quite a lot of what is going on with this work as a portrait, yeah. I think. You know, we get the visual information, but we, I guess, in an English language version, and presumably the other international versions, we don't get all of that other, those other forms of kind of linguistic and style communication.
But I think that from the archival point of view, the thing with preservation is that you probably want to start a preservation from the negative of this film, or from the master, and rip off these subtitles now, because I think you probably get a copy, they made something called the Colombian Cinema Suitcase,
mm-mm.
which is sent to embassies across the world for cultural programs. And there is a big fight now about the Colombian suitcases going on social media, because finally it's out there that there's censorship in those Colombian suitcases. And most of the times, I mean, number one, this is organized by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, not by the Ministry of Culture. So the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, of course, I don't know how it works in England, but in my country, it has big investment on the beautiful face of the nation. Mm-hmm. Let's not talk about violence. Let's not talk about Pablo Escobar. Let's forget that there was a conflict here, that so many people died. And so they choose films like this because they are good representative of hardworking women, and it has the handcraft element that exoticizes the country so much. But at the same time, they curate the subtitles because it's only important for foreign audiences that they know so much about these women. So, and that's a big discussion. The history of subtitling is a big discussion in the archival world now, because in every single country you will find that, in a way, it's a way to silence the speech of these people so that you do a disservice to the film.
Yeah, and it's very ironic because both films that we saw are about labor. And, mm-hmm. of course, what is effaced through perhaps an inability to conceive of funding the labor of mm-hmm. capturing that speech is taking place in a film which is otherwise about the minutiae of labor and the way that labor functions and takes its toll on those who labor in that way. And I guess that's the thing I liked about both of the films and seeing them together in this way, is they're both about that. Mm-hmm. And whilst, yes, it's what Gayatri Spivak would call an example of the information retrieval method of feminist scholarship, where you go to a community, take something and bring it back, and it's all about that act. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, these filmmakers are using both of these subjects to express something that does exceed the bounds of what they say they're doing, this desire to capture mm-hmm. the positive image, the more complex image. Both of these films are about the toll taken, you know, in being a woman in Colombian society, whether in a condo in the metropolitan area or the coastal rural area where Carmen Carrascal lives.
I think it's very interesting in ¿Y tu mamá qué hace? What does your mother do? That's a very common setting of the films from 19... The Focine films, they were always, we call them urbanizaciones, because they were not very fancy houses. They were like new projects that had like, they were affordable by families. But people, I remember so much that my family, at certain point, somebody proposed, let's move to one of those things. And I was like, why? We have this beautiful patio. We have trees. We have eucalyptus. Why do we want to live in a little box like that? But it's also like a token of a very middle emerging class, no, that they are emphasizing. And then that plays very well with Rita va al supermercado. Rita goes to the supermarket. It's like the side B of that. No, because it's also work. No, it's economic work. You have to make economic decisions for your family.
Okay, let's throw it out to you to see if anyone has any questions.
B. Freeman, I'm from Liverpool. Film producer, I was very interested in your archival stuff and the way we have a repository. Mm-hmm. We're in a bit of a flux at the moment. We captured in 1972, Michael Jackson came to Liverpool.
Mm-hmm.
I worked in a community centre with a group of young people, and we captured that interview. They allowed us to capture the interview. And it was shot by a student on a Bolex 8mm mm-hmm. Bolex camera. Now the position is, when Michael Jackson passed away, all the media wanted to try and get that footage.
Mm-hmm.
I've got the footage now personally, but who does the footage belong to? Does it belong to the community centre? Does it belong to the young people that did the interview? Does it belong to the guy that actually filmed it, who loaned us the camera? So that's the way it stays at this moment in time. What we are going to do with the footage is we're going to give it to the Museum of Liverpool.
Mm-hmm.
So that way it can be for use, for everybody can see it, for use of public. And that's the...
Yeah.
What is your
but I think that? I think that's very important, because you had that set of slides when you were introducing the activity, that in many cases you see in museums, in galleries... In exhibition spaces, that they have the papers, the documents for the documentation for a collective, which I really think is something that we have to work on. Cine Mujer, no, those papers have to be somewhere, and I imagine that there's plenty in those boxes. When I show the image of the rack, there are boxes around that are in very bad condition, and I imagine that there are photographs, contracts, documents, scripts, and we really need to recover that material. But then, of course, it depends to who you're giving the material. There's always the question of provenance. No, because that's the thing that the museum will ask you. We have to make a document on how this came to your hand, because provenance is what will allow them to show or not. And I think it's your question can be compared to what happens to many of these collectives. Now, yours is a tougher case, because after leaving Neverland, it's very tough to work with Michael Jackson material, no? But I don't know how much you can, but yes, I know to what extent you can repair all archives. Like, if they wanted to do, ¿Y su mamá qué hace? What does your mother do? Yeah. They're going to have to probably clear the copyright for that song at this moment. Now, none of the people that is in the credits at this moment can come and
claim loyalties, because that's another thing that happens with the archive. Sometimes you give yourself to the task of recovering the work of someone, and people tend to think that there is a lot of money, mm-hmm. and that you're doing that because that's going to generate a lot of money. And I'm going to tell you something that I always say. There's nothing, the worst enemy of archives are families. Divorced husbands, divorced wives, yeah. children from different families, no. Because the moment that you say, I want to organize this archive, people think there's money there. I want my portion, no. So I don't know how the Museum of Liverpool will work it out. But what I do think is that when you are generating archive or you're trying to organize an archive, it's very important that at least the organizing of the archive starts with very clear legal procedures, so that you don't run into these kind of problems. That you show, because I know filmmakers that use songs and they don't have the rights and they still put the copyright on the copyright mm-hmm. sign, but they have all the documentation that we have been looking for the owner of the song. No.
Thank you. Okay, you have a question there? If you could speak up as well, just because the people at the back. Yeah, that's
yes,
great. Thank
hi.
You.
My question is really about a bit more about the technology mm-hmm. and how that's affected the participation and the visibility of women. Because you referred, I mean, the period from the 80s mm-hmm. until now has been this acceleration mm-hmm. of, different technologies, broadly speaking, from 16 millimeter mm-hmm. to video to digital and full digital panoply. So on the one hand, that's a challenge to women, and I was quite surprised mm-hmm. that you identified Marta as the only person, in a sense, still who mm-hmm. who goes through all the is qualified in all the processes mm-hmm. of the production of a 16mm film. Then it raises the whole question of how there's a sort of pedigree, mm-hmm. if you like. Well, there certainly was in this country, in terms of women coming from a cinematic tradition, you know, maybe the National Film School or whatever, and women who join it through television. And there was mm-hmm. a sort of, real hierarchy there. Mm-hmm. And then I suppose there's the whole question of how, what is the role of television as mm-hmm. the sort of intermediate mm-hmm. platform for dissemination in familiarizing with us with the history that we know. Mm-hmm. And then I suppose then it goes on to social media. Is that a liberation, or is it Google taking mm-hmm. the role, or da 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 da? So technology is hugely present mm-hmm. in this kind of thing.
Yeah, it is.
Good.
Just contest.
I guess most of the early films were shot in 16mm. Mm-hmm. And nowadays they are, most of them, they are in DVDs in the library, mm-hmm. in the National University, in the library of Mujer y Género, where they gave it. But still, there is one film that you were thinking about screening here. I think it's Paraíso Artificial.
Two films we were considering screening. Patricia's directed film, Artificial Paradise, and the Gaze of Miriam as mm-mm. well.
Mm-hmm. And one of them is, they have a 16mm copy, but it's faulty, so they have to restore it, and that hasn't happened because they don't have the funds all the time to do it, or the
funds.
funds. So most of their work is in DVDs, but it's not online, so it's kind of stored in a physical place at the University Nacional. And there is this particular film that can't be watched because there is, I think, only one copy in 16mm, that is faulty.
Yeah, I think we talk a little bit about optical media, no? Because the problem is that people think that optical media does not degrade. Optical media degrades. It gets data rot, no? It also gets a lot of problems in addition to obsolescence. But I think that there are many layers. I'll try to give you a short answer. Television was very important, and of course, I tried to center my conversation on cinema. But that's why Gloria Triana is very important, no? Because she was making this cine para televisión, cinema for television series. But back in the 70s, when one-inch quads and two-inch quads came to Colombia, no, the grandparents of video for the younger generation here, like the big, big boxy ones, it was actually a woman who brought that technology to Colombia. It was Consuelo Montejo, who used to be She used to be a militant with the Maoists. I don't think she was part of the ELN, the National Liberation Army, but she was sympathetic of them. She had a contestatory TV news series, news reels called Teletigre. And she is the one that brought that technology, and she knew how to upload those 1-inch, two-inch quads that were extremely, they were heavy and they were difficult to put. And then, of course, magnetic media in Latin America, television has been dominated by magnetic media. And the issue with magnetic media is that magnetic media also decays. It gets something called a sticky shed, doesn't lose the emulsion like cinema, but it develops a lot of problem. And when you were showing your little piece of Sarah Bright and Dora Cecilia, I mean, I love when productions show the history of technology because you had the flickering, no, the instability of the image in those VHS tapes, no, which is probably because they have been close to magnetic resonance, no, or they have been poorly stored. The real damage to magnetic media is poor storage. It always has to be vertical, by the way, it can never be flat. And so, but it was very important because it was not really, magnetic media, let's keep in mind, it was not born as a way to make cinema. It was born as a production element. Filmmakers pretty much realized this is cheaper doing it this way and appropriated as a way to make film because it lowered the cost. But it's also something that can be erased. And so there's a lot of loss of material because for the sake of expenses, people will erase the tape and make another movie in the same tape. News reels or something. People, and you probably in your house there has to be a VHS, a mini DV, a Hi8, a U-matic or something. If it has the red tab, pull it out. Yeah, because that's the safety. Then you can, when you remove the red tab, you cannot record on top of that. Yes. Cassettes, magnetic media was absolutely important. So I think that if we were going to do an inventory of the archive, I am convinced that these women were self-sufficient. They had been educated abroad. Eulalia Carrizosa comes from a very high-class family in Colombia. Her parents are diplomatics now. Sarah Bright was also a wealthy woman. I think that she went to the National Film School here.
Yeah, that's
now.
We remember
her.
Yeah, we
remember her. Uh-huh. Oh, wow. Wow. So they were very skillful. But and I think that the problem is that we are in a country where still women are not trusted with technology. It's something that I've been working in the last years because digital technology does give a lot of independence to girls. And you have 8-year-old girls, 10-year-old girls that are not afraid anymore to pull out a phone and make a movie. No, and they know all the gadgets. And for me, that's one of the blessings of digital technology. We grew up in a generation that your parents would be like, don't touch the camera. No, you're going to break it. Don't touch the TV. Wait for your father to come and do the LP records. No, that belongs to your father. And this generation, they touch everything. It's a very haptic generation. They touch everything. They need that contact. No, and I think that it has been changing. It has been the relationship. I think there are wonderful women working with technology in Colombia, and it's historical. Our job as academics, as archivists, is give them visibility. Now, I think the best Sony disc, I don't know if you will agree, but the best Sony disc in Colombia right now are women. Pilar Perdomo and Isabel Torres. No.
Sound recorders. Yeah, sound designers.
Sound designers, and it's very complicated technology what they are using. No. And there was another thing that was very important on what you said. The Jorge Tadeo University, which is not a leading university in the country, and they hosted Los Lugares de las Mujeres en el Cine Colombiano, my conference. They were very important in the 70s because they had some money at the time and they could buy equipment. And they had never really had a great filmmaking program, but they have always had the equipment. And so filmmakers used to come there to play. And those women were invited, or they were very astute to come as the girlfriends of the guys and play with technology. Yeah.
I have one final question for Lorena, but please also contribute, Juana, which was about something you said in your presentation about the film we had wanted to show, but because of a lack of a subtitled and adequate copy, we were unable to. Also, it's not one of the ones we were celebrating in Cine Nova's collection, and that's Miriam's Gaze. Mm-mm. Do you want to say why it's such a great film? What is it about that film?
It's a really interesting film directed by Clara Riascos. Debbie Martin has written about it. And it's a film that in some ways translates feminist debates into the documentary form. But it's not a documentary because it kind of challenges the boundaries of documentaries. It includes an interview with Clara Riascos, who is this woman who lives in a shanty town. But also it kind of makes her reflect about her own childhood, her relationship with her mother, and about her dreams, and it dramatizes those dreams and her childhood as well. So it has fictional elements. And then it reflects about her work with the community in that shanty town and the relationship with the sons. So technically it's a very well filmed and edited film, and also the story is really interesting, creative, and the way that it kind of reflects about the cinematic apparatus and about different issues that were debated at that time amongst feminist film theorists, but also within the Colombian context, mm-hmm. that were really important to Clara Riascos, so reflected in that film. Yeah, I think that can be watched in YouTube, though. Low quality.
A very low quality version is on YouTube. Okay. Any further questions? One more here.
Yeah, a little question for Lorena. Can you tell us a little bit about the provenance of some of the clips, archival clips that you've used in your own documentary?
Mm-mm. So I've used different clips from some of the films. Itumama Keace, for instance. Also from Llegaron las Feministas, which is kind of the document that they made from the first encounter of feminists that took place in Bogota in 1981, and from the second encounter that took place in Peru, I think 2 years later in 1983. And I was interested in how some of the debates that they took place in those encounters about women's labor, for instance, were then represented in their films. And then I added a bit of Carmen Carrascal and Clara Riascos, as well as an example of this when they were talking about the fact that they wanted to give this alternative image of women, not drawing from kind of feminist filmmakers from the States. So try to represent women who work in their communities and who were active and independent. So I tried to illustrate that with images of Carmen Carrascal and La Mirada de Miriam, because those films were there too, that kind of made these portraits of women, of their complex.
And you were the filmmakers themselves that gave you the materials?
I got the material from the National University in Colombia. And then I asked the filmmakers to use those images, and they saw this video and they were fine with it. So
you got them from DVDs?
Yeah.
Even for this film, you ripped them out from DVDs? Yeah.
I was going to ask, you know, you got the film from the university. Was there a consent form from the individuals ever signed?
No.
You mean in the original films?
Yeah.
I think they didn't have consent, that kind of consent form practice in the moment when certainly Carmen Carrascal was filmed. It wasn't a convention, but clearly on one level they had her consent. But as I already said earlier, they also went away from that consent and a very explicitly expressed wish that she had not to use the song. Okay. So they did use a song, but they did show it. We think they showed it to her, as Lorena has said, but we don't know what she made of it. So these are, you know, these are items in the archive which can still give a great deal of, I mean, viewing pleasure, and obviously information and an essay film experience, but they're not without these concerns as well. Things are, you know, they're not sort of straightforward pieces that we can show without contextualizing them on all of the levels that I hope you agree our brilliant speakers have done for you this morning. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we'll see them again later.
But I think there is an important thing in what you are saying, and combining with what you say, that that's precisely why
things that cannot be repaired on how procedures were done 30 years ago, we cannot make the same mistake when we are organizing the archive.
Yeah.
So I think like writing a two-page history of why these films should be made available to public and making people aware, if you download this film or if you take it, please credit not only the filmmakers, the person that is in the film, but the people, the institution, the foundation that organized the archive. Because no, that's how access, these are the people, I think a problem with Cine Mujer, of course, I don't think it's a difficult restoration process, and there is money in Colombia for this kind of restorations. There's funding in Colombia for cinema, and this is something that is very easy to lobby at the international level. The problem with this is who wants to write a grant, because these women, obviously, for 30 years, they had not cared. Patricia might care, perhaps Sara, no. But writing the grants, because everybody here probably has ever written a grant, is an art. It takes time. Yeah. No, so I think that's the thing, is getting the funding. But I don't think it's a difficult project. I don't think at all it's a difficult project.
Okay, we will see more of Juana and Lorena later, thankfully, in
thank
the
you
conclusion
so much.
And the roundtable that will conclude our day. But we have an hour for lunch now, so thank you very much for the morning to everyone involved in it.
Thank you.
Just a quick note about lunch. We have a cafe in the building from which you can buy things. There's also a kiosk in Gordon Square, which sells great food as well, sandwiches. And then in Gordon, in Tavistock Square, the next door square, there is are a few chain outlets. I will refuse the name, but which also serve very fast and quite nice. Okay, see you back here at 2.
Sí, no, es maravilloso.
Y luego también otro libro también que me ayudó mucho fue uno que me dieron en Patrimonio Fílmico, que se llama Documentales Colombianos 1950-1990.
Sí,
es un catálogo
Pero esos catálogos se pueden convertir, es una beca lo que Cine Mujer necesita. ¿Vamos a comer? ¿Ustedes ya se conocieron?
¿Cómo se llama?
Juan,
¿y de dónde eres?
De Armenia, Quindío.
Ah, de Armenia.
Sí, ¿Colombia?
Sí, estaba varias veces.
I will be in touch about your stuff. Yeah.
And let's try to organize something on Friday. Let me know when.
Yeah, I will let you know. I'm interviewing most of the morning and early afternoon, so this will probably be after 3.
Yeah.
Is that okay? Brilliant. This is so great. I'm Juana. Yeah. So I'm just interested in establishing a network. Create the digital resource on
Cinemaware. Yeah, amazing.
Maybe we can apply for a sort of network grant to do that.
That'd be interesting. I have most of the films. I need to make sure that the copies are right.
Compiling all of the stuff that's been written out there.
And then documents, I guess, doing
what she suggested, having a meeting with them, bringing everyone together to bring all of their stuff that they've got. Amazing.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm not going to come to this afternoon, so I'll just say goodbye to all the others. But yeah, mention to her. I would be interested in doing it.
Y cuando quieras que colaboremos o algo, nosotros tenemos un programa ya de colaboración con España de
mi universidad. No, está sacada. ¿En dónde? Sarán, ya. Pero bueno, vas a hacer la conferencia en Madrid, ¿no?
Sí.
Nosotros tenemos un programa muy grande en América Latina de colaboración con archivos. Y hemos hecho mucho community archiving. Hemos estado en Perú, en Uruguay, Argentina, Chile. Vamos para Puerto Rico ahora y estuvimos en Brasil el año pasado. No. Y hemos hecho, tenemos alianzas en todo lado y hemos enseñado a hacer community archiving, como que la gente mire el archivo con otra disposición y con otra mentalidad. Que no sea como allá está el burócrata con mi archivo, sino el archivo también me pertenece. Yo tengo como usuario, como investigador, como persona cuya historia también está contada en ese archivo. Y casi toda mi investigación es eso, cómo descentrar el archivo de los poderes estatales, ¿no? ¿Cómo te aprovechas del archivo? Esta actividad, con lo importante que es el mujer, bye, Debra.
See you later.
She's the blonde one with short hair. And she's still acting. She writes about cinema and fashion. And she's trying to make get funding to make feature films.
Y ahorita de su película Guapa, Sky, Amazon Prime, the first one just 25 years ago. I just got her to scan it. Because she's 65, she's tired, she wants to see the world of souls. And we did a production in New York. I was not here, but they were filming. It was called Visually Language. So they usually have to ask how to find the price.
But I would love to be able to go to the
I mean,
I
Caribbean. Depends on what date of September, because I have to be at
the time, and it is much better.
I have to be in your conference.
I remember that.
home and watch them draw.
No, pero sí hay que hacer reescritura, ¿no? Hay que mirar el contexto
cultural porque da cosas.
Sí, a mí fue el grupo de Cali no solamente le han dado un protagonismo como que lo único que se hizo en Colombia en 1970 y no es cierto. O sea, recuperando el trabajo de Héctor Rebella, estaba la cinética con el subterráneo. Barranquilla también tuvo una actividad de cine. No, pero lo que pasa es que ocurrieron en mi tierra.
Okay, cool. Okay.